Welcome back. I'm Jason Rantz, live from the Cairo Studios, Carter Subaru Cairo Studios. Join the conversation online. Go to CairoRadio.com, click on the Linwood Honda inbox, search for the name Jason Rantz, or of course, Facebook.com/Jason Rantz Show, R-A-N-T-Z. When Steve Hunsaker and Griffin Walker tweeted they'd do anything to get two tickets to Sunday's game against the St. Louis Rams, the Seahawks challenged them to perform 12 random acts of kindness. Now, the duo spent all day today doing just that, and they were tweeting their progress along the way. The dozen acts started with the two taking a photo of a family at a large Christmas tree near the Pike Place Market, but the team said, wait a minute, you just took a photo of some people at Pike Place? No, 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 no. That is not good enough. That's not kind enough. You better start thinking a little bit bigger. And so the pair did. From there, the two helped a homeless man with a sale of a Real Change newspaper. They gave a personal escort for tourists trying to get from Pike Place Market to the waterfront's Great Wheel, because apparently you can't see the big Great Wheel from Pike Place Market and you need to be escorted down there. They bought an outside balloon vendor a cup of coffee to withstand the chilly afternoon. The acts became a bit larger as the afternoon progressed. They bought three women Seahawks-colored flowers, cleaned the floor at Mick's store at Pike Place Market, and one of them donated his favorite hat to a little Seahawks fan. Next, it was on to pick up a random family's parking tab near the market, then volunteering at the Green Tortoise Hostel. Number 11 was spreading the message of kindness and giving back through social and traditional media, all leading up to their 12th and final act, volunteering at Union Gospel Mission to help feed dinner to those in need. Hunsaker and Walker said that the Seahawks have informed them that they failed miserably and wouldn't be getting the tickets. In fact, they now owe the Seahawks the cost of the tickets for not being... Well, okay, no, I made all that up. Seahawks said, yeah, you did enough. You earned your Seahawks tickets. They will be now among the pair of 68,000 plus strong cheering on the Seahawks as they hopefully defeat the Rams Sunday afternoon. And I just spotted an error.
What's up with the hopefully? They're going to beat the Rams.
I don't want to jinx it. In my head,
don't
I think
superstitious. That, okay, they're going to win.
We're going to kick their backsides. Let's be honest. Although I just pointed out in this story that I got from Como News, this is how the story ends. Seahawks did do enough to earn the tickets, and the pair will be among the 68,000-plus strong cheering on the Rams Sunday afternoon. I just copied and pasted that last line. Como hates the Seahawks. I'm kidding. And I'm sure it was an error.
That's not what I heard.
But that's kind of an important error. You mean the Seahawks.
Yeah, that's pretty bad.
And look, oh God, you and I had a little bit of an argument before the show about this story because, I like the idea that people are doing kind things. I love the publicity stunt basically by the Seahawks. It's a smart one. It does good for the community. It gets people talking. It's cute. I like it. But is it really an act of kindness, a random act of kindness, if you're getting a prize at the end of the day? If they're basically saying you do these random acts of kindness, which are not random because we're telling you to do them, and we will give you, we will bribe you with these tickets, with this prize, a prize that's worth a lot of money. And I sort of like, I'm glad they did the kind acts, but they did it for a monetary gain. They did it for a prize. They basically had to be bribed. Now, at the end of the day, I would have loved it if these two people were just doing random acts of kindness and they happened to be Seahawks fans and the Seahawks were all like, I'm going to reward you for doing something good. Here's two tickets to the Rams game, the sold-out game this Sunday. I want to reward you for all the good you are doing for this community, for volunteering at Union Gospel Mission, for helping to wash the floors outside of a market at Pike Place, for escorting the tourists down to the Great Wheel. Good for you. I'm going to give you this prize. But instead, I feel like they only did this to get a prize at the end of the day.
I actually think it would be worse if they picked these two guys for their acts of kindness when there's so many people out in the Seattle area.
Sure.
Doing so many great things for people that deserve a day off and a Seahawks game ticket.
Exactly. And this is the real, I hope someone from the Seahawks is listening because this is a really good program for them. go into the community and find those people who are doing what they can to help things out with their neighbors, their friends, their family. Go out into Washington State and find those people and reward them. But the fact that these two guys just basically did some good just for the reward is sad to me. And you and I were discussing it earlier. You didn't initially have any problem with this idea that we're basically bribing someone to do good.
I still don't have a problem with it. And to go back really quickly to the idea that you just pitched, I think that's fantastic. And to flesh it out a little bit more, what if we have those charitable people who got free tickets also get to be in the picture with whoever's raising the 12 flag that day? Just work them into there. That'd be such great PR, and I think that'd be such a cool way to give back to the community.
I agree. And frankly, they might already be doing that because the Seahawks tend to be really good for the community.
They're really good about
that stuff. They are really good partners to the community. They are fantastic in their charitable effort. So they may already be doing that. And I'm not going to down-talk the Seahawks organization for this particular piece, but I just like the idea of people doing something without any bribing involved. There was a story.
For the intrinsic value, not the
exactly.
reward.
Exactly. The actual reward should be the hug you get at the end of the act of kindness from the person you helped. The reward should be, you know what, I did some good for someone else.
That fuzzy feeling of like, I helped that guy.
Yeah. And you know, some would say that's also selfish to have that feeling. But I'm going to throw that out there and
say it's a good kind of selfish.
That's a good kind of selfish that I accept. And I did the story about 2 weeks ago or so right here about how to get kids to eat vegetables in school. Cornell University and Brigham Young University, they did this study basically saying that of the $5.5 million in extra funds that went towards purchasing fresh produce, fruits and vegetables for kids in cafeterias, something like 4.3 million of that was wasted because kids were just throwing away all of the vegetables and the fruit and they weren't actually eating the broccoli, the asparagus, the strawberries, the melons.
Although, to be fair, kids throw away a lot of food, period.
Absolutely. But they were very specifically targeting the vegetables and fruits to throw away because, you know, when you're a kid, you foolishly don't like vegetables and fruits. And so these two universities, they got together and they're like, okay, well, let's figure out a way that we can get folks, these kids, to start eating the vegetables. And one of the things they started to experiment with is basically bribing. They would say, if you eat these vegetables, you get put into a contest for a potential prize. At the end of the day, you get this little ticket and you may win the raffle. Maybe we give you a quarter or a nickel or a dime every time you eat your vegetables, and then that adds up. And the findings found that, yes, actually, that does work. These kids will start eating their vegetables. They will start eating their fruits because they're getting something in return. But what happens when they stop bribing the kids, according to this study? They stop eating the vegetables. And so they don't eat the fruits anymore because they're not getting something in return. And I look at this act of kindness deal, and I hope that these two guys, Steve Hunsaker and Griffin Walker, they continue to perform these random acts of kindness without expecting something in return. And that's where, you know, when I see someone getting rewarded for something like this, I'm like, that's sending the wrong message.
I also think that when you do reward somebody for doing something good, whether it's eating right or doing good deeds for others, you're also encouraging them to acquire that taste, whether it be for that type mm-hmm. of food or for helping people. You never know what people will be introduced to with programs like that.
Well, we found out, at least from this one study, they're not going to eat delicious strawberries and asparagus unless you're giving them some sort of monetary value in return.
I bet you they will when they're adults, though.
Well, everyone starts to turn to vegetables. And what is it about when we're kids, we don't like the taste? I love the taste.
Unrefined palates.
Oh, my God.
Sugar and fat is what tastes good.
Parents out there, force feed your kids as many vegetables and fruits as possible now. Get them to understand how good it is because
it's the reason why I love okra now.
Oh, I don't like okra, actually.
A lot of people don't.
Yeah, it's, I don't like the it's too
slimy is probably what you're looking
for. Greasy feel. It's just gross. I'm Jason Rantz and I hate okra, but I love asparagus and broccoli. When we come back, Barbara Walters has this special at the end of the year, the most fascinating celebrities. I'm going to tell you who's on the list, and I'm going to tell you three celebrities who said, yeah, I don't want anything to do with your stupid list. When we come back, I'm Jason Rantz.
Welcome to Not For Weddies Only. we'll be talking to an actual living legend, the incredible Marlena Deutschwend.
Barbara Walters named Hillary Clinton her number one most fascinating person of 2013 on a list that included Miley Cyrus, Robin Roberts, and the cast of Duck Dynasty. I think that's kind of cheating because that's not a person, but I'll go, you know, okay, I'll grant her that. But according to a new anonymously sourced report from Radar Online, there were three big names that turned Barbara Walters down. According to a source close to production at ABC News, Jay-Z, Kristen Stewart, and Robert Downey Jr. all chose not to appear on Walter's show. The real story behind the show is who turned down a sit-down interview with the Queen for her annual special, the source said. Typically, Barbara very carefully starts approaching people in September for the special, but she always accounts for getting turned down by some of her interview targets. They start with 30 names and narrow it down to get all the interviews done for Thanksgiving. To fill in the Hollywood ingenue slot, Walters ended up including Jennifer Lawrence, who I would say is way more fascinating. Way, 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 way leaps and bounds more fascinating than Kristen Stewart. I can't understand any fascination with Kristen Stewart. She has this amazing ability. And actually, maybe this is what's fascinating about her. She can be talking about just giving birth to a child. She can be talking about winning, you know, 250 million, mega million lottery dollars. And she just doesn't crack a smile. She doesn't show any emotion whatsoever.
You know, Stephanie was on set with us constantly on this one. And it was so cool. I mean, she's been involved since the get-go, but...
That's her excited voice.
I was so connected to her. Like, I felt her presence. It was like she watched everything. And that energy is the most contagious thing in the world. And I couldn't find anyone that like loved it as much as me, except her.
Like, that's as exciting as we literally searched the web for something like her cracking a smile and maybe her voice going up an octave to express some sort of some interest in the subject. Nothing, right? That was the most excited we can find.
I hear it really translates to the screen too.
Oh my God. You know, she plays the perfect characters because all of her characters have to be just really morose and really monotonous in their tone.
She has a good agent.
She does. I honestly can't figure out why Kristen Stewart is fascinating. I can't figure out why Robert Downey Jr. is still fascinating. A few years ago, when we were still learning about his past addiction problems, I'd be, yeah, he's made this comeback. He's getting back on the big screen. But now he's doing the third Iron Man movie. At that point, is he really fascinating? I mean, not really. What does he have to offer that we haven't heard before in the past? You know who I find as an actor is utterly fascinating, at least his career, is Ryan Gosling. He manages to play the exact same character in every single movie, and yet I'm utterly fascinated by him. The Place Beyond the Pines, one of my favorite movies of the year, he plays the exact same character than he did in Drive, which was at that time my favorite movie of the year. He's in a movie called Only God Forgives that not a lot of people saw. Exact same character.
On Netflix now.
It is on Netflix for streaming. It's not very good, but he's fantastic in it. And he just plays the exact same character. Robin Roberts, she's fascinating because she overcame cancer. I mean, a lot of people overcame cancer, and that's a great feat. And I think, you know, God bless her for being able to do that. But she's a celebrity who overcame cancer, and I guess that deems her as interesting. I mean, if we're going to go to television hosts in the most fascinating category, wouldn't you go with like someone like Paula Deen?
I think we're getting a sense for where the bar is for Barbara Walters.
It's very low. I mean, she's got Jay-Z, and Jay-Z is interesting. I wouldn't say fascinating. You know who's fascinating is actually the person who ended up replacing Jay-Z, which was Kanye West. He is fascinating.
Yo, what's up, Yeezus? I'm a big fan, bro. I love your work. I love your work.
I appreciate it, but don't talk.
Right, I love your work, though. Bro. That's fine, but yeah. Don't talk to me. Sorry. I don't want to hear paparazzi talk to me or anybody I know.
I'm a field reporter.
But don't talk to me at all.
I'm a huge
and
fan
don't
of
talk
that.
To anyone I know
all right.
at all. And tell everybody never talk to anyone that anyone knows.
I feel that.
Don't talk to themselves.
I feel that.
Don't talk ever again.
He got so angry. I find Kanye West to be, his ego is so huge. I think he is utterly fascinating because, granted, he is a talent. There's no doubt about that. But he is way more talented in his head than he is in real life. And I'm granting you that he's a very talented person. I've never experienced an ego than the type I experience when I watch anything having to do with Kanye West.
He thinks he's a genius, and he will be the first person to tell you so.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. But what really bothers me about this list is the number one choice, Hillary Clinton. She's done nothing especially fascinating in the last year.
Other than Benghazi hearings, that's the only notable thing she
did. And she should not be considered fascinating for that particular point.
No, she should not.
She should possibly be shamed for her role in what ended up happening in Benghazi. And the what truly bothers me about this, the only reason she's number one is because Barbara Walters wants to push her in this pedestal of the next presumed candidate for the president of the United States. That's all this is meant to do, is to raise her profile even more because she thinks she's going to run for president. You know who's actually someone who should be number one on that list if you're going in the political realm?
Edward Snowden.
Well, Edward Snowden's on the list. I don't think he should be number one. When we're talking about people who are in politics, who should have made that list instead of Hillary Clinton, is also someone who's running for president, likely, is Chris Christie. That's someone who, by all measures, should not be considered someone who is a front runner. He's brash. He's mean. He's kind of a bully sometimes. He is a Republican who wins in New Jersey, and he's really, really morbidly obese, which we don't look to in political leaders. He's fascinating to me. Hillary Clinton? No, this was a blatant political move by Barbara Walters to bolster the chances of a Clinton presidency, and that kind of annoys me. Coming up next, we're going to get back into some of the unemployment numbers. Unemployment benefits, extended unemployment benefits are being cut tomorrow. We'll talk a little bit more about what that means. And we'll talk about how we should be really talking about this conversation when we come back. I'm Jason Rance. Welcome back. I am Jason Rance. Over a million Americans will see their extended federal unemployment benefits come to a sudden halt this weekend. And nearly 2 million more will also lose their long-term unemployment if a deal isn't reached by the middle of 2014. CBS News' Major Garrett has a story.
This will hit about 1.3 million Americans, those hardest hit by the Great Recession, those we call chronically unemployed, jobless for more than 6 months. Now, during the Great Recession, Congress provided jobless benefits for, in some cases, more than 90 weeks. Now, that's been cut back to 73 weeks in some states, but starting tomorrow, anyone jobless longer than 26 weeks will receive no benefits at all, and that benefit averages just over $300 a week.
This program was started under President George W. Bush to provide a cushion for those millions of Americans who lost their jobs in the recession and failed to find new ones. So why did this happen? Why are these folks losing their extended unemployment benefits? These 1.3 million Americans, did it have to happen? In fact, didn't we just pass a budget, a bipartisan budget?
It wasn't a part of the deal because Republicans, particularly in the House, did not want to include these benefits without finding some way to pay for it with offsetting cuts. It cost about $25 billion to keep these benefits going. And quite honestly, the White House did not put up much of a fight. Now, there is a bipartisan Senate bill to extend these benefits for 3 months. That's kind of a temporary fix. President Obama said he will sign that legislation if it gets to his desk. This will be the first item up for debate when Congress returns after the new year. Now, if it passes the Senate, its future in the GOP-controlled House is still uncertain, but Democrats have been pounding this issue this week and promised to keep up the pressure early next year.
CBS News spoke to one jobless American in Washington, D.C. She says she does not understand why federal unemployment benefits vanish tomorrow. Here's Joanna McDonald.
Just cut somebody's unemployment off, you know, off for whatever reasons they see fit. I really don't agree with that.
Well, that's generally how it works. But Dan Mitchell at the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian think tank, has something to say about Americans collecting unemployment.
The best thing we can do for the unemployed is to reduce the burden of government so there's real strong private sector job creation. It's not good for the unemployed to trap them in permanent dependence on government.
Now, Dan Mitchell argues that these free checks at the end of the day instill bad work ethics in the folks who collect them.
This has been years of subsidized joblessness, and that's the key problem with these payments from the government, they encourage people to remain idle. They lose their work skills. Academic evidence, including from people like Paul Krugman and Larry Summers on the left, when they're writing for academic audiences and not being political, everyone seems to agree that you get more unemployment when you have extended unemployment payments.
What I'm annoyed with is that this will turn into another silly political fight where both sides attack each other. The right will be demonized. They will be sort of the victims of some more character attacks, saying that, you know, the GOP doesn't care about poor people. The GOP doesn't want what's best for this country. Even though at the end of the day, they have a reasonable request, right? I mean, I don't think people think that this is unreasonable. It's very simple. They want to be able to pay for the program before they fund it. They're saying, hey, if we're going to do this, let's find the money somewhere. Let's not say that we're just going to raise taxes. Let's not go further into debt for this program. Let's look at the budget. Let's look at the money that's there. I'm sure we can find some instances in which, you know, we are using our funds inefficiently. This is the government. This is the federal government. I guarantee you that there are some inefficiencies there. Let's find that, and let's use those savings to pay for the programs. If we can do that, then sure, let's do it. But at some point, someone has to say, some party has to say, hey, we can't just keep writing checks. We can't just say, hey, we're just going to throw more money at a problem, even though we may not be able to pay for it. Someone has to have that unpopular opinion amongst the 1.3 million people who are relying upon these extended unemployment benefits and say, hey, we got to do it the right way. We can't keep going down the line and saying, hey, we're just going to keep paying for it. We'll let someone else deal with the consequences. And of course, this is going to become, as I said, this partisan battle. We already see some of the ads going up. This is an ad from Americans United for Change.
You know who had a Merry Christmas?
Who?
The richest 1%.
Oh, God.
That's who. Republicans in Congress made sure of that, protecting billions in taxpayer giveaways. And for those facing tough times, Republicans stripped 1.3 million Americans of jobless benefits. Folks who want to work but cannot find a job, kicking them to the curb during Christmas. So to the 1.3 million Americans losing benefits, Merry Christmas from the GOP. It's wrong to leave more than a million Americans behind. Tell Republicans, restore unemployment benefits now.
You know what's truly wrong is taking up a legitimate debate, a reasonable debate, one that has to happen, and turning it into some partisan hack job from some group called the Americans United for Change. Yet Republicans are so evil. They want just to protect the rich. They want to demonize the poor. It's not possible. It is not possible that maybe both the Democrats and Republicans want something good to happen for the poor. It's not possible that the Republicans and the Democrats might want what's best for this country, but they perhaps disagree. Perhaps just a little, disagreement on how to get there. No, it's black and white. It's good versus evil. If you do not support what I want, you're evil. If you do, you're good. And the funny thing is, in this debate that the Democrats are now saying Republicans are so bad for, the White House didn't even fight for this program to be funded within this last budget debate. They didn't fight for that. Yet I guarantee you we're going to get some statement from the White House saying they are upset with this decision. This will hurt the economy. This will hurt the working class. This will hurt families. And the Republicans, they are evil. Or worse, they're racist. Because if you listen to Michael Eric Dyson on MSNBC, he basically said there is a racist element to the folks who don't want to keep writing blank checks to extend the unemployment benefits. They're racist. And of course, what do people do when they can't really argue a point? They just label someone a racist. Because other than maybe a child molester or a pedophile, the worst thing to be called in the society is a racist. And then you're put on the defense. You have to prove that you're not a racist. Instead of actually having a discussion, a civil discussion, a discussion of substance on the merits of the actual program. And what is missing from all the coverage? Go right now, go to CNN.com, go to FoxNews.com, read up the stories from the AP or CBS or ABC or NBC News, and look up stories about these unemployment benefits that are going to be cut tomorrow. What's missing from the coverage? This is a portion, an excerpt from a CNN article. Pay attention because I'm going to quiz you, Producer Nick. I'm going to quiz you. Here's the article. Michelle Marshall is one of the 1.3 million long-term unemployed Americans who will lose unemployment benefits Saturday. Marshall, 56, has been out of work for a year since she lost an administrative assistant job that paid her $44,000 per year. She started collecting $624 each week in New Jersey unemployment benefits, but the state benefits ran out after 26 weeks. When federal benefits kicked in, she collected $521. But Marshall will stop getting these checks next week. When the benefits stop entirely, she doesn't know what she'll do. Quote, I imagine I'll go apply for food stamps. Depending how long this goes on, I might lose my car, which will impact my ability to get a job. I won't be able to drive to interviews. Now, the rest of the article had nothing else to do with this woman, Michelle Marshall. It just basically gave the 101 on what the story is, on the benefits going out. What is missing from that article?
What's missing from that article?
Yeah, what about Michelle Marshall's story is not represented?
Well, I mean, it seems like that little anecdote is mostly used to engender sympathy.
Absolutely.
For her situation. So I'm not exactly sure what would be missing from that narrative.
Very simply, the cause of unemployment. Why is she unemployed? Why is she without a job? Is it because she was laid off? Is it because she cannot find any work in her field, in the communities that she lives in? Is it because she is an older American who maybe doesn't have the skills necessary to compete in a current workforce? Why? What happened? What happened in her life that caused her to not have this job anymore? And when we're talking about unemployment benefits, and when we're talking about the long-term unemployment benefits, and we're talking about long-term unemployment, isn't it important to find out why they're unemployed? Doesn't that seem to be the most important piece of information to find out why it is they are actually getting unemployment benefits? That's not a throwaway. That is not something that we can simply overlook. That seems to be the crux of this very argument. The Republicans are saying, hey, we'll fund it if you can pay for it. The Democrats are saying, we just better pay for it. We've got all these people out of work. But no one's saying why they're out of work. No one's having that conversation. No one is actually addressing the problem. And there are a ton of problems. It's not one problem. It's many problems. And there's not an easy answer. And when there's not an easy answer, what happens? Well, politicians, they don't want to get involved. If it's not an easy answer, they want to go to what's easy. And what's really, really easy? Demonizing the other side, saying they just don't want to fund it because they don't care about you. And then the other side says, well, you know, it's not worth our money. We got to do something else. But no one actually talks about why people are unemployed. That should be the question we should be asking. Because if our ultimate goal is to get people off unemployment benefits, and I think Democrats want that, and I think Republicans want that. I think everyone wants people to be off unemployment insurance, unemployment benefits. Shouldn't we ask, well, why are they on it to begin with? And shouldn't we say, hey, you know, the labor market is changing. Jobs are not there the way they used to be. How do we create more jobs? How do we put in place policies and programs to actually grow the workforce? How do we make the United States a more business-friendly environment if the perception is that they're not? Why don't we look at the effects of Obamacare is having on the job force and the job market? Why don't we look at the fact that so many jobs are going overseas, why that is, and how do we keep them from going there? Why do we continue to villainize capitalism and the rich? And the rich, by the way, who we're villainizing, they're job creators.
Is whatever happened to personal responsibility for getting oneself employment, though? Because it sounds like what it would take in order to get that kind of information and be able to go case by case and really analyze these situations, it sounds like a lot more spending and a lot more government involvement in people's employment.
And maybe that's the case. But you see, the difference is we're not putting money into that. We're putting money into people who are on unemployment. We're not putting money, not enough money, into getting them off. I would rather spend the $25 billion on programs that get these people jobs, not that just keeps giving them money and not really having any attack plan on how to get jobs. That just seems like a fundamental flaw in this entire discussion. And it's really what we talked about with our guest, The Economist, last hour. It's like, we've got a problem, but we're not actually tackling the cause. We're tackling the symptoms of a really bad jobs market, a bad labor market, an economy that's struggling. Our people can't find jobs. Okay, well, let's fix that. Don't just treat the symptoms with some Tylenol in the form of paychecks for not doing any work. Let's say, hey, here's the attack plan. Here's the game plan. Let's go after that first. That seems to make more sense to me. But no, that's not what's going to happen. What's going to happen is we're just going to yell at each other. We're going to demonize each other. We're going to demonize the other side, and no conversation is going to happen, and we're not going to make any improvements. We're just basically crossing our fingers and hoping something will change. And that's not good enough. That's not good enough for the 1.3 million people who are on long-term unemployment. Join the conversation online, CairoRadio.com. Click on the Linwood Honda inbox. Search for the name Jason Rantz. I am Jason Rantz, and I'll be back.
Cairo Radio 97.3 FM, Seattle's news, Seattle's talk.
Welcome back. I am Jason Rantz. Join the conversation online, facebook.com/Jason Rantz Show, R-A-N-T-Z. In college, I was told that only white people could be racist. The only people who could be racist are white people. And I was told that by a number of professors in college classes when we talked about issues of race. And what was their main purpose? They were saying, well, black people cannot be racist. And the reason they can't be racist is racism is all about power. It's all about having power. It's not necessarily just about your thought process and your feelings towards another race. It's about the power you hold in society. And because white people have all the power, they're the ones who are racist. Everyone else, they're not racist because they don't have the power. But apparently, and thankfully, that paradigm has shifted a bit because apparently now Questlove is racist. Questlove is African-American. He is the drummer for The Roots, who I think is on the Jimmy Fallon show, right? That's the house
they're
band.
They're the band for the Jimmy Fallon show.
And they're also a regular band. They're a huge band.
Grammy-nominated. I think they've won some Grammys, too.
They're fantastic. They're actually a really good band. And they're on tour in Japan. And Questlove is, like most celebrities, he's hooked up to the Twitter, to the Facebook, and to the Instagram. And in this case, the Instagram got him in trouble. He took a photo of this miniature train in Japan, and he posted underneath the photo on his Instagram photo, "Is it racist for me to write the sour train?" Which is the stereotypical sort of interchanging of the L and the R consonant. And it's, you know, it's a stereotype. We've all heard it. Flight lice. Like, we've all heard people use that stereotype to make jokes. And as he posted that, a friend of his, Padma Lakshmi, who is the host of Top Chef on the Bravo network, she responded, "Ha, ha, 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 you rise, clack me lup." Also poking fun at the language barrier that they perceive Japanese people to have when they're talking in English. And Questlove further posted an Instagram video of a woman speaking Japanese, and he wrote this, "Ladies and gentlemen, they are talking in tongues." And there was all this outrage. They were labeled racist. Questlove and Padma Lakshmi, they were labeled racist. And a blog that does cover, you know, pop cultural items, they went on this tear about how racist this is. And social media, of course, picked it up. People were retweeting and going after Questlove, and Questlove finally apologized. He said, you know, I was being inconsiderate. It was just a joke. I'm sorry. I didn't mean it. I'm not actually racist. And when I saw this story, I was like, it's not really racist. I don't necessarily view it as racist. It's not necessarily racism. It is insensitive. It's racially insensitive. There's no doubt about that. But when I talk about racism and when I'm willing to label someone a racist, it's got to be about the intent and the hatred in their heart. It cannot simply be a bad joke. We have all made bad jokes. We have all made tasteless jokes. We have done that before. Sometimes we do it without even realizing it. Sometimes we do it because we think it's funnier because it's tasteless. People make really bad jokes, and sometimes people make racial jokes. That doesn't make you a racist, unless in your heart you legitimately feel this superiority because of the race you have to someone else's race. Is it a stupid joke? Yeah. Is it a funny joke? Not really. People have been making that joke for God knows how long. It stopped being funny a really long time ago. Is it shocking? Yeah, I guess it's still a little bit shocking when you hear it coming from someone you don't expect them to make that sort of joke. But is it racist? I would say no. I think we have to have a higher bar before we just simply say someone is a racist in this society. Because, like I said last segment, that's one of the worst things you can actually be called in this country. And have that label permanently attached to you as a racist.
Now, I think you're making a great point here, because I do think that a lot of media today jumps to the conclusion that somebody is a racist just for doing a racist thing. And I think that...
Or a racially insensitive thing. Because, again, I wouldn't put it this way. If someone... When you call someone a racist, like they're calling Questlove, you are equating them to, for example, someone who has committed lynchings in the past. Someone who has terrorized black people in a Klan outfit. Are you putting them on the same level? Because there's not levels of racism, right? We don't say,
yeah,
hey,
there are.
No, we do not say you're racist light. We don't say that. We don't say you're racist version B. We say you're racist.
But there is subtle racism.
There's subtle racism, and that absolutely exists. But when you label someone a racist, you label them a racist. You're not labeling them levels of racist, okay? When someone says you are a racist, that's all they say. You are labeled a racist. People do that all the time, and the bar is so low. And then in a related story, the Italian distributor of 12 Years a Slave, the movie 12 Years a Slave, recalled and apologized for posters that focused on Brad Pitt and Michael Fassbender, as opposed to the movie star Chiwetel Ejiofor. Of course, Brad Pitt is white. Michael Fassbender is white. Chiwetel Ejiofor is black. Now, they're calling this racist. In fact, they called the posters absolutely racist, so much so that this company had to pull them down. Is that racist? No, it's not racist.
It's certainly racially pandering, though.
Is it racially
pandering? To an audience that they think is racist enough to want to go to the movie for a supporting white actor rather than the...
Totally disagree. Here's the deal. Chiwetel Ejiofor, name some movies he's been in. The average person has no idea who this guy is.
Was he the guy in Kinky Boots?
He was, but no one's seen Kinky Boots except for you.
Because it's a British movie, though.
Yeah, but I'm saying no one knows who Chiwetel Ejiofor is when you compare to Brad Pitt.
He was also in Love Actually.
He was in a lot of movies, but he's never been the leader of a movie. This is the first leading role he's had. And you go to Brad Pitt, World War Z, made $337 million in the foreign box office. That's more than it made here in the United States. Curious Case of Benjamin Button, $206 million, more than it made here in the United States. Troy, that god-awful movie from Brad Pitt, $364 million it made, foreign box office. That's more than double what it made here. It's possible. I'm just saying it's possible that they saw Brad Pitt as someone who would get butts into a seat over Chiwetel Ejiofor. That makes the most sense to me. And so just again, to automatically go to the racist card, you're a racist for doing that. Think about it before you just label someone a racist. Have the bar just, I'm not even saying make it incredibly high that you can never hit it. Make it just a little bit higher than it currently is. And I think we can really improve race relations, certainly in this country and in the world. I'm Jason Ranson. I just want to cure racial issues. I'll be back next week. Up next, Coast to Coast.